Hello, and welcome back to the Life and Death podcast with me, Stephen Rumford, brought to you by Ashgate Hospice. I've worked in palliative care for 25 years, so in this series I sit down with all different types of people to discuss their experiences of death, dying and bereavement, with the aim of finding a deeper understanding of what life and death means to them. In this episode, we're going stateside as I speak to Rebecca Soffer. She's a writer, author, a journalist, and the co-founder of Modern Loss, a resource dedicated to people experiencing bereavement. When she was 30, Rebecca's mother, Shelby, was killed in a car accident 1 hour after dropping Rebecca off from a family camping trip. Then just 4 years later, her father died of a heart attack while on a cruise to the Bahamas. At the age of 34, Rebecca was describing herself as an orphan. As a result, along with her friend Gabriella, they started Modern Loss. So we recorded this remotely. I was in my home in Derbyshire and Rebecca in her apartment in New York. And I was really interested in talking to Rebecca. I was interested to hear how Modern Loss works, at what age you have to stop calling yourself an orphan. In fact, we had a great chat about, well, my experience as well as of being an orphan and what a strange feeling it is at any age. And she told me about how she's found a new strategy to deal with grief through this community that she's started. So keep listening for that and more on this episode of the Life and Death podcast. So firstly, Rebecca, welcome to the podcast and thank you for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me today. I'm delighted to speak.
Rebecca, we're going to dive in, I guess, really. You know, time is short and we're going to dive in. Because in a way, we're here because of what happened with regards to your parents. And I just wonder whether you would just give us that first person, you know, story of your parents and their death and how you responded over the time.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's very safe to say that working in the field of grief communities would not have been something that I would have chosen while growing up as a career path. In fact, if you had given me the choice, I would have been like, I didn't know you could do that because I just wanted to become a journalist or a DJ that played for Mars. You know, I had all my childhood dreams. And, you know, as many of us know, the universe has its own plans for us. And when I was 30, I was working as a daily TV producer for a very popular show here in the States, which also aired in the UK, called The Colbert Report. It was a political satire show. I had just received my master's degree in journalism from Columbia University, and I was just starting what I really felt was the build stage of my life. Yes, at age 30, yes. But when you live in New York, when you're 30, it's like you're 20 in any other place in the world, let me assure you. And so I went on a family camping trip with my parents, my mom, Shelby, and my dad, Ray. I was an only child between the two of them. And the night of that camping trip, my parents dropped me off at my apartment late at night, and they continued driving south to Philadelphia, the city where I grew up, which is about 2 hours from New York City. And I got a phone call about 45 minutes later that there had been a terrible accident on the highway and that I really needed to get to a hospital. And that phone call was just like the entry point. And I don't even want to say like I walked through the doorway. It was like I was like ejected from a cannon into the next stage of my life, which is, I call it the after. You know, everything beforehand is the before to me. And I learned when I got to this hospital that my mother had not survived this terrible accident that had happened on the highway. My dad did survive and was had minor injuries, but, you know, got the crappy award of having to live with the loss of the love of his life, who died next to him. I suddenly didn't have a living mother, which at age 30, sure, yes, that sounds older, but I assure you, I felt like I was five. And I felt so alone. And I felt like suddenly the person who I assumed would be by my side as I hit all of the milestones that I wanted to hit in my life was no longer there, not just to be a witness and a cheerleader, but just, you know, to be help, you know, like with my kids, with life, with everything. She was my touchstone for everything. And so the reason that I founded or co-founded this community, Modern Loss, which is in its very basic iteration an online magazine, but has grown immensely over the last decade into a global community and a movement, is because I just felt so lonely. And I realized what a stigma it is to talk about this stuff. And I got really sick of it.
Modern Loss as a project was started after your mum's death or after your father's death? And that, I just in terms of timing.
Yeah. So my mom died when I was 30 and my dad died about 4 years later when I was 34. So definitely not my life plan to have no living parents by the age of 34. I didn't have kids yet. I had just gotten married less than a year beforehand or about a year beforehand. And Modern Loss came out of those two experiences. First, the loss of my mother, and then the loss of my father, with whom I was extremely close. But I would say grieving his death was also more existential because it marked the fact that I had no living parents. And so Modern Loss came after that because I waited several years. I waited, we launched it in 2013. My dad died in 2010. And I wanted to wait until a time when I didn't feel like I was in the rawest part of my grief. And I could do it from the standpoint of like, yes, I'm the client because I know loss so profoundly and intimately, but also I know how to do this. I know how to publish, write, edit, assign. I know how to pull this together. So it was really like I knew I could do this very well from a professional standpoint because I understood the audience so well.
So there's a couple of things that when I read through the website and I've, you know, looked at some of your other stuff, the thing about being an orphan, because when my mum died, which is my second of my parents, which I've spoken about here, it's definitely a feeling of being an orphan, isn't it? It's definitely something quite distinct as a state. And we'll go on to Modern Loss, but I'm just curious about your bit more of your journey with that before Modern Loss and what the when Modern Loss was a thought and then when Modern Loss was a thing. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I actually really like talking about that because I have a good laugh when I remember it. Well, first for me, you know, my dad and I were super close. We were like peas in a pod and not just in the best ways. You know, like I would say that both of us are very creative and witty and we love wordplay and we're both writers. And, you know, my dad was an entrepreneur and he was an advertising executive. He had his own advertising agency, very like Mad Men type situation. But when we also butted heads so much because we were so stubborn and we had strong personalities and we wanted what we wanted. And so when he died, you know, I struggled with not just the grief over his death and over no longer having that dad, you know, to cheer me on. I struggled with all the things that I wish I could have said that might have like tied everything up with a little bow, which I don't think anybody ever gets from having so many conversations over the years. But thirdly, I really struggled with this feeling that you were just saying, which is like, no matter how old you are, I think you just feel like this little kid when your last parent dies, regardless of the quality of relationship that you had. You know, I think all types of that loss, you know, regardless of the type of relationship that somebody had with a parent is a real profound one. And I was 34 and I felt like I was this tiny kid. I felt so exposed. And I also felt existentially like I was suddenly snipped from everything that had tethered me to my foundation, to witnesses to my childhood, to a sense of home, physical home. I felt like I had nothing before me and I certainly had nothing after me because I hadn't yet had my kids. So that was a real existential thing for me, which was super weird. And guess what? It remains weird to this day. It's never not weird. Grief is weird.
No, for sure. Thank you. Because that was it's a very recognizable state that you've just described, I think. I love the untethering. I don't love it at all. It's absolutely terrifying. But I love that word because that is definitely, I think, a sense that we have when we're grieving, particularly finding ourselves as, you know, the next in line, as it were, if we, you know, once they've gone, it sort of shifts the whole kind of target shifts, doesn't it? You know, you're looking around.
You said what I didn't, which was like, yeah. I'm the oldest one now. And that's really weird because I'm 34 years old, you know? Yeah, it's an odd thing.
Yeah, exactly. I wondered, I know from listening to some of your talks that you sort of wandered a little bit to try and find some guidance, help through therapy. And you know, I'm trying to get at something like when the realization that spending time initially with people who are in the same boat had some certain potency that maybe just seeing a counselor professionally, online or in person, somehow didn't quite have that. That shared experience had a certain power. And then suddenly I can imagine modern loss is like, wow, you could amplify this. Could we amplify that connectivity and that commonality of experience and use that? I might be just putting words in your mouth, but it feels like something like that must have gone on, whether it was an epiphany, a single moment, or just a growing sense, I don't know. But I'm curious about the women who dined together. I'm curious about that little grouping and what was behind that.
Yeah, that's a great question. And you're right. I think that, you know, I learned, and I believe this, and one of my missions in life is to spread this gospel that grief is not a pathology. It is a universal experience. And since it's not a pathology, you don't have to just talk about it with somebody who is licensed. In fact, community and peer-to-peer support fills in immensely where clinical therapy leaves off. You know, you can only talk to a therapist, what, once a week, twice a week? That's a lot of hours left in your day. You need a community when you're moving through hard things. You need people who are willing to divide up your burden and carry just a little piece of that on their shoulders because it makes you feel seen in your hard thing, acknowledged in the fact that you're going through something really crappy and that it looks really hard. And that makes you feel less lonely. And so, yes, I, you know, was seeing a grief counselor who was great, you know, awesome. She was fantastic. But then I started getting so lonely because I was like, wait, every night I'm like, I wish I could still talk about this with somebody, but I'm scared to because I'm scared that people are going to think I'm like morbid or morose or the Debbie dark cloud in the room. And I worked in political satire. Like, I'm not the dark cloud, you know? But I had dark things that I really needed to share with somebody. And one day, a friend of mine in New York texted me, and I really didn't know her that well. She was like a really good acquaintance through another good friend. And she said, here's the deal. My dad's dead. He's been dead for 15 years. Your mom's dead. I know like three other women who have dead parents. Why don't we just like have some lasagna at my apartment and some really cheap wine? Because we were all working in the arts and journalism. And I was like, you know what? Screw it. Let's do it. And I did not know this woman well. I didn't know any other women. And I thought it was going to be like grief group, you know? And I went and we ate. And no one said anything, and we made small talk, and we talked about, you know, pop culture and whatever. And then finally, after we were finished our meal, one of them started speaking and sharing, you know, and saying like, okay, well, why don't we just talk about the real reason we're here? And the first person to start sharing opened up the floodgates for the rest of us. And it was just like this exhale, this emotional exhale, just this feeling of like, oh my God, I can let it all hang out. Oh my God, I don't have to pretend it's all okay. I don't have to pretend that it's not messy. I can laugh about weird things with these women. I can laugh about like funeral stories or like these nightmare dating stories of like dating with a dead mom and like your date doesn't want to talk about it. And it just felt so terrific. And I hung on to that. And every month we would meet, and I named us Women with Dead Parents because clearly I should be up for a Pulitzer in literature one day. And it had to be at someone's place. It was never out at a restaurant. It just had to be someone's apartment, which is a tall order in New York City because apartments are really tiny. And we formed this bond. And I don't know that I would have otherwise become friends with these women. But we had this common denominator. And it was just this proof through showing and not telling that some of the deepest connections can be made through being raw and vulnerable and real about your hardest things, you know? And it was just the best. And for me, that was, you know, that was the feeling that I wanted to replicate by launching Modern Loss, which, you know, started as a website. And now, you know, I've written 2 books. I speak all over the world. We have readers all over the world. And my goal is to pull them out of their own isolation, make people feel seen in their hard thing, show them through other people's stories that they're not the only ones going through something that looks like that. And we want to teach people what it feels like. Not through this, it is hard to go through grief. No, like, what does it feel like? Like, what does it look like? How does it change your life? How does it change how you make decisions? How does it change how you navigate intimate relationships or the careers you choose? I mean, we're trying to show that grief is all. It affects every part of us. And it is not just like 365-day period of time that conveniently ends on day 366.
Sure. No, we have the same thing here. Most people's expected grief ending time is after the funeral. It's usually after the funeral. It's like, well, that's enough time, isn't it? Surely.
Send them to me.
Surely. Because the website is extraordinarily rich. It is an extraordinarily rich website. I haven't bottomed it out, but there is a lot. And the way that you've structured it, I mean, maybe you could say a little bit about that. Because there is a structure to the website, isn't there? There is a kind of, you can pick in terms of the particular kinds of grief in terms of who's died and what that might be like, about father, son, mother, daughter, grandmother kind of section. And then there's lots of stories about how individuals are living with it in real time, is my sense. It isn't just one story. There are thousands or hundreds of stories. I mean, there's a lot of stories.
Yeah, thousands of pieces. Yeah. Well, when we launched the site, you know, this was a decade ago. And first of all, I should say that everybody around me thought I was really nuts and morbid for saying, you know, people would say, what are you working on these days? Because they expected me to say, well, I'm working for this comedy show now instead of that comedy show. But instead I said, you know, I'm working on this website that I'm going to launch as soon as I figure out how somebody launches a website. And it's going to be great. And it's going to be like about grief and loss. And it's going to be funny. It's going to be all the things. And people were like, that's so morbid. Like, why would you ever want to do that? And my reaction was always, I didn't have the guts to say this in the moment, but my internal reaction was like, you're so lucky that you think that's morbid, because I actually think it's like run-of-the-mill daily life for me, and a really normal thing. And I just want other people to know that this is a really normal thing, so that they don't feel like something like this is actually morbid. It's not. And so, yes, as you say, the site is organized very, I would say, in like a very rudimentary manner in terms of types of loss. We don't shy away from everything. You know, we talk about suicide, about, you know, AIDS-related illness, about stillbirths, murder, you know. And you know why? Because people who are survivors of those types of losses are normal people who are made to feel very abnormal in their circles because of the type of loss that they have suffered. Because we're not just talking about the type of relationship, we're talking about what comes out of a loss. You know, how do we change? How do we make decisions differently? Or what do we notice different about our personalities? Are we more anal now? Or are we more like throw caution to the wind? You know, are we scared to be a parent? Do we want to be a parent? Do we, you know, like, I want to change careers? There are just so many different things that come out of the real profound experience of loss that we could have subcategorized till the cows come home. We just figured it wasn't worth it.
What do you think's gone wrong? You know, like your friends say, well, it's just morbid, or, you know, we can't talk about grief after this period of time, whatever it is, that we somehow are still so frightened about talking about death, even though the reality, as you say, is everyone's reality.
Yeah.
We don't know. How do we not know how to do this, given that we've been doing it forever? How do we not know how to do this?
Yeah. I mean, look, I will say, I think we've gotten better at doing it. I think we've gotten notably better over the last decade since I've been doing it. When I started doing this, I was very just out there with my tone. I was very unapologetic. We use a lot of humor on our site. So I think that, yes, we've gotten better thanks to the internet, thanks to low touch platforms like, you know, Instagram, Twitter, blah, 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 which I know are probably going to take down humanity for the most part. But in terms of like allowing people to ask others to bear witness to their pain, that's been a real gift. But as you say, we still do kind of suck at this. And I'm like wondering why, because we're surrounded by grief. We're drowning in it. Look at what we've been going through since 2020. I think a lot of us first don't like being reminded that our time is limited. You know, we don't like that. I don't like that. We don't like envisioning, you know, I think that a lot of us kind of subconsciously feel like grief could be contagious. Like if we engage with somebody's story too much, maybe we're somehow exposing ourselves to it happening to us. You know, like if we learn too many details, maybe we're kind of becoming more vulnerable to that happening to somebody we love or ourselves. And I know that might sound crazy, but I actually believe people kind of subconsciously feel that way. It's like they're allergic to getting too close. You know, I also think that, you know, we do like feeling human beings, we're into ourselves. We like feeling important. And we like feeling like, you know, we have the ability to take away somebody else's pain or lessen it. And so when we realize that we can't, because she's in a better place, somehow isn't cutting it, I don't know why, we then kind of stop reaching out because we feel impotent. You know, we feel like we're not making it better for that person. There are just so many reasons that we don't like engaging with this topic. But the thing is, I wish that everybody would realize that A, grief isn't contagious. I can't believe this is a thing I have to say, but it's not. That B, the more that you don't ask somebody about what they're going through or acknowledge it, and not just in that first month or that first year, but forevermore, like put a Google calendar note for somebody's death anniversary or like a Mother's Day when you know somebody's going through a hard thing and reach out to them. The more we don't do that with people, we make them feel so invisible and we actually fill them with resentment and with good reason because they're not feeling acknowledged in their hard thing. They're feeling erased. They're feeling othered. And it makes it really hard for them to feel like they have the energy and the capacity to have empathy for others and be there for others, because why should they be? No one's there for them, you know? And I also wish that people would realize finally that none of us is really that important to somebody else, that it is our singular sole job to remove their pain, that we don't have to come up with the perfect thing to say. Because there is no perfect thing to say. The perfect thing to say can always be, I wish I knew the perfect thing to say. I'm so sorry. I heard your dad died. I heard you had a miscarriage. I heard your brother was killed in a car accident. I heard this thing, and I'm so sorry you're going through this. And I have to tell you, I don't actually know what I'm supposed to say, but I'm so terribly sorry and upset for you. And I'm really would like to be somebody you can talk to if you feel comfortable doing that. I mean, that is so easy for somebody to say to someone else. It's free. It costs nothing. And if we all got better at doing that and realizing that there's no vaccine for grief, it's not our job to cure somebody from it, then I think we'd be a lot more comfortable engaging with the topic. Yeah. I think we'd feel like the pressure was off.
Yeah. Well, we'd almost be better being comfortable with being uncomfortable, essentially, isn't it? It's kind of just sitting with that. I often say to people, I mean, they'll say, you know, how do you, I say, well, you can't really get it wrong. All right, you can get it wrong. I mean, you can, I know your book and your website has quite a few examples of how people can kind of get it wrong. But I think if you're engaging and you're present, you can't get it wrong somehow. You know, saying nothing is more of an error. Avoiding is often more of an error than, as you say, if you go in just fumbling your way in, as it were, just to find connection, just to extend something of a connection as a human thing. So the thing about the website is there are so many stories. I really enjoyed reading them. They were like little snapshots of people's life. I don't do social media, so I don't know what Twitter is like or what. But this was lovely. It was like these little sort of snapshots of people's real lives. So it's varied. So there isn't a single answer. But I would wonder whether since starting it and since being it, I mean, so involved, do you have a kind of top tip top two tips, like just two things that just are so generic, so cross all of those, you know, race, sex, gender, that are just like this, or don't do that?
Yeah, I mean, sure. And so many. And one of the tenets of modern loss, one of the tenets is no judgment here. You know, as long as you're not hurting yourself or anybody else, you do you when it comes to grief. However, we do reserve judgment for a small part of the conversation, which is in how people support others. I think there's this whole suite of platitudes that I just don't know one person in the thousands of people I've spoken to over the years, even the most religious faith people of deep faith, who have been helped by them, which are, you know, please just try and stay away from these trite comments, like they're in a better place, or comparing you know, like saying, I know exactly what you feel, like my dog died, I know. And by the way, a dog dying is a terrible thing. That's your own grief. But like trying to assure someone that you know where they're at, I know it sounds really odd, but it actually does kind of silence them, because it makes them feel like, oh, they know how I feel. I guess they're not asking me to share how I feel. You know, I know it sounds like a real subtle thing, but this is what I've learned, you know, or the, you know what you should do. You know, assuring somebody, you know, they should go back to work, or they should take time off. Nobody knows what they should do except for themselves, you know, or the, you can always family, you can always date again, or you're still young, you can have another baby, all these things that just negates and erases where somebody is at in that moment, which is having a really hard time with some other thing. People are smart. They're aware that they can always do something in the future, you know, they know that, but that's not what they're asking you to do. They're asking you to sit with them in that moment. And I think also just the second most important lesson that I've learned, and probably the first, is that this is just so nonlinear. There's just like no natural linear progression to this experience of living with loss over the long arc, that it does not have, you know, five stages, the way Elizabeth Kubler-Ross described for the dying. You know, I think that we've just had this thing in our culture where we've absorbed that as like how you're supposed to grieve too. But that's not it, right? Like you're nodding and shaking your head and you're smiling because you know exactly what I'm talking about. You know, we both know that's not how it works. I think that living with loss is 24/7 for the rest of your life. But that's not meant to sound like kind of a sad, scary warning. It's meant to say that you should feel normal if you're having a terrible day years down the line, or if you're in the supermarket and you see, oh my gosh, where would you be over there? Sainsbury or whatever.
Yeah, well done. Yeah. Well done.
Grabbing, thank you. You're welcome. Yeah. Like grabbing a, I don't know, one of those like very specific sandwich combinations that you guys have, like cheddar and like onion sandwich. and all of a sudden you're reaching for it and you're in a place with your person in the past, and you're remembering a moment that took place either there or in a different setting, or you shared that thing together, you know, this is all normal. You know why? Because grief is a dynamic living thing, because you are alive. And as long as you are alive, your grief is alive, because you very much still have a relationship with your person, even after they've died. And that is not meant to sound cutesy and Pollyannish. It's just very real. You do have a relationship with them. You can still come to learn more things about them, regard them differently, see them on different levels as you go through life, you know, even have conversations with them, share with them. You can learn how to forgive them. And that is what I've learned, really, which is that, like, it's a forever thing that's in no particular order, but that's okay, you know? It is what it is.
Great. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. So Modern Loss website, just go and Google. This is me giving my technical skill level here. There is something called Google, I believe, and you can put in Modern Loss and that you're number one on there, because I have done it. It is a terrific resource. It's a very, very generous thing you've done. You seem to me to have taken a deep and profound personal tragedy plus a deep and, you know, personal existential time. And you've intelligently learned how to manage that manage sounds drier than I mean it to be, but do you know what I mean? To live with that, to adapt and mold your life around it, and then generously have extended it out into the world. And that's a very lovely thing that you've done.
Thank you. I very much appreciate it. And we do have the website, modernloss.com. And also, I've written 2 books, and the last one is a bestseller in a 3rd printing. So that could be helpful to people. It's called The Modern Loss Handbook, An Interactive Guide to Moving Through Grief and Building Your Resilience. And it is published in the UK. So it is available, you know, on Amazon, online, in bookstores, wherever books are sold, you can ask for it. The Modern Loss Handbook. It is, I wrote it in the depths of the pandemic with 3 goals, which is to help people figure out how to stay connected to their person, how to stay connected to themselves, and how to stay connected to the worlds around them. So it's divided up into 3 sections and has portions where you can write in it as well.
Brilliant. You can doodle.
You can doodle, yeah, you can write, you can
I'm down with it.
Crumple it into ball, throw it across the room. I won't take it personally. I won't be there.
Look, Rebecca, thank you so much. You've been extraordinarily generous. You know, with you and good luck with the venture, really. I hope it goes from strength to strength.
Thank you so much, Stephen. Thanks. It's been really delightful chatting with you today.
So I really enjoyed that chat with Rebecca. Her enthusiasm, knowledge and experience really shone through. And what she's created, it really is an extraordinary resource. If you've been affected by anything you've heard in this episode, you can head to our website, ashgatehospice.org.uk, where you can find lots of resources. This episode was produced by Olivia Swift and Aisha Williams and is a Reform Radio production. You've been listening to the Life and Death podcast by Ashgate Hospice. I've been your host, Stephen. Thank you, and we'll see you again next time.